the pandemic continuing to wreak havoc with Boeing's finances. This as the company tries to regain the public's trust after two deadly plane crashes. Second quarter earnings came out today. They are not pretty. Chris has the numbers for us, Chris.
Yeah, Boeing lost $2.4 billion in the second quarter, marking the third straight losing quarter for the company. Revenues for the quarter coming in 25% below Q2 of 2019 at just under $12 billion. And as you remember, Q2 of 2019 was no picnic either. This was just after the second of two 737 MAX crashes. So that tells you a little bit of perspective on just how far the revenues have now sunk for the company. The delivery numbers reflect the lack of confidence in the MAX and the reality of the global pandemic. Nobody's buying new airplanes or even taking significant deliveries because global passenger traffic has virtually disappeared. CEO David Calhoun is addressing investors and reporters right now.
Commercial side, our industry and our company are weathering challenges like none we have ever experienced in our lifetimes. And many of those challenges are still unfolding.
Boeing only delivered 20 commercial airplanes in the second quarter. It has only delivered 90 for the year. That's off over 70% from last year. The company, though, is still reporting a backlog of over 4,500 planes.
We continue to believe that the fundamentals that have driven air travel for the past five decades and doubled air traffic over the past two decades remain intact. And we believe this industry will, in fact, recover. But we currently estimate it will take around 3 years for travel to return to 2019 levels.
The plan is to stay as liquid as possible right now as a company. That's why we saw the layoffs. That's why we're seeing what they're doing with consolidations. This as airlines continue to trim their services.
Airlines have cut back operations dramatically. As they assess their business, they are making difficult decisions that result in grounding fleets, deferring airplane orders, postponing acceptance of completing orders, and slowing down or stopping payments. They're also accelerating aircraft retirements, deferring elective maintenance, and requiring fewer services.
As for the production rates going forward, the 777X first delivery been pushed back to 2022. The combined 777 line will be reduced to just two planes a month next year. 787 production will be reduced to just six planes a month. And there is word that Boeing is trying to decide whether it will keep only one 87 production line, which might leave Everett out in the cold, considering that North Charleston produces the 787-10, the largest of the airplanes there. As for the MAX, it's expected to reach 31 planes a month in 2022, and Calhoun expects deliveries to begin again this fall.
Based on our latest assessment, we now expect the necessary regulatory approvals will be obtained in time to support resumption of deliveries during the fourth quarter. Of course, the actual timing will ultimately be determined by the global regulators.
And Calhoun just mentioned that what we all knew was coming, production of the 747, the Queen of the Skies, will end in 2022. However, he said that's not the end of the service to the airplane. The airplane's going to be flying for decades to come. On the defense side, it's really keeping the company afloat right now. Q2, about even with last year, revenues $6.6 billion.
I want to go back to the 787 production line in Everett. You're saying there's talk that it could close?
That is correct. The word on the street is that for a couple of months now, considering the orders and what people are looking for in their airplanes right now, that we're competing again line for line between Everett and North Charleston, whether or not they will consolidate those lines. And considering that we fly a lot of the fuselage or the fuselages from South Charleston in the Dreamlifter over to Everett to produce them, there is considering that North Charleston might be the leader in keeping that one consolidated line, especially since it does make the 10-10, which is the largest of the airplanes. So there's some cost savings to be had there. Boeing is looking at this. I'm not sure what our time frame would be to Horizon and figure out what they're going to do. But the folks there in Everett, if I'm on the 8-7 line, I'm a little nervous right now.
How many folks work out there in Everett?
Thousands.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, at one point, that was the largest freestanding building in terms of acreage in the history of man.
Wow.
So that would be a huge blow for the not only the folks there but our economy up in Snohomish County.
Yeah, Cairo Radio's Chris Sullivan. Thank you for the update, Chris. The debate over defunding Seattle police by at least 50% continues at the city council this morning. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott says you can expect more protesters in the streets until the final vote. set for next week.
The final vote is expected Monday afternoon and will be preceded by a large march and rally starting at the Youth Detention Center to City Hall, organized by the groups working with council members on a defunding plan. While 7 of 9 of the council members have loosely committed to the idea, it's not clear how everyone will vote on the specific budget plan when it's finished. That's why multiple organizers of recent protests are calling for supporters to step up efforts to send a strong message to the council between now and that final vote. With at least one march and rally a day planned, emails and phone calls to council members and whatever else they can do to keep the pressure on ahead of the vote. Councilmember Shama Sawant spoke at a rally meant to pressure the council at Seattle Central College on Capitol Hill last night.
My message to all the council members is, you have a better proposal than this? Fine, we will support that. But what we will not support is excuses for not defunding SPD by at least 50%.
After speeches, the large crowd took to the streets for a peaceful demonstration calling for the city to meet demands of defunding SPD, investing in communities of color, and calling for the resignation of Mayor Jenny Durkin, among other things. Durkin has not said much about the calls for her to step down, but has been weighing in on the demand for 50% cuts to SPD this year and next at community town halls this week.
On the funding itself, Chief Best and I have made very clear that we don't believe you can have a drastic cut of 50% this year or next without impairing community safety for everybody. Almost all of the vast majority of Seattle Police Department's expenses are in personnel. So to make those cuts, you would be cutting the number of police officers. And that, we believe, would not enhance public safety. The chief has been with this department for 30 years. She has a deep sense and tie to the community and wants to make sure that as we reimagining policing, we do get a different kind of response possible. But she also has an obligation to make sure that she can provide true public safety in every part of our city.
It remains to be seen how the council will decide to cut SPD, whether it will be this year or next, and whether there will be actually any research done ahead of time to make sure there is a clear understanding of the public safety implications for all communities. Whatever the case, those who've been taking to the streets in protest have promised that they'll be in the streets until the Seattle Police Department is cut by at least half.
Let's cover Radio's Hannah Scott. She joins us live. Hannah, you're saying they could potentially cut the Seattle Police Department up to 50% without doing any significant research on how that could affect public safety?
I don't know that they've done. It's not clear what they've done thus far as the research goes. And if they vote next week, you know, it goes from there. So many feel that this has been kind of a rushed process.
Yeah. And at this point, I know we've heard from 7 out of 9 council members who have said they support defunding SPD by 50%. That's a veto-proof majority. Is there any chance that this doesn't pass at this point?
I don't know what the final proposal will look at. Today is going to be a big day. This is their last big, huge debate on what this budget, this specific budget issue is going to end up, the proposals that they're going to vote on is going to look like. It's going to come out of what they finish up today. So there's a chance. I think it's very difficult to do it in 2020 for the last half of quarter of 2020, which is one of the things being asked for, given the police union and some other legalities that have been brought up by the police chief and the mayor. But some on the council say that there's a workaround, that there is a way that they could do it if they really wanted to. So I don't know. And it's not been completely, it's not exactly black and white with the 7 of 9 who say they support the cuts by 50%. It's not clear. So I think it's more likely than not to pass. Exactly what form that takes, I'm not sure.
Yeah, Durkin has talked about, you know, potentially 20% of cuts to the department. What has been the response from SPOG, the police union, amidst all of this?
They are fighting hard against this. Mike Solon, who's the president of the Seattle Police Union, he has just put, I think it was yesterday, released a petition. They're trying to get folks who support them and support the number of police that we currently have to sign a petition and send that message, their own message, to the council that people don't support this. And there are a great many people in the city who do not support this, who are concerned about public safety in other communities and what this kind of thing would do. You know, you have the chief and SPOG saying that 800 officers would be lost if this happened. But on the other side, you have some who are calling for the defunding by 50%. Who really want an all-out abolishment of the police force. So competing sides, the police union also put out a video yesterday, a little scary probably to the community, that talking about how many officers will be lost, how long it would take to have response to 911 calls and things like that. We'll have to see who ends up being right and who wins.
It's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
As we've heard from our resident historian Felix Bennell over the past few years, underwater archaeologists and other sleuths have been working to solve a handful of Northwest mysteries dating as far back as the 17th century. And Felix is here this morning with an update on three of those stories. Do any of them involve a kraken, Felix?
That'll be for next time.
Okay.
A story we first did 3 years ago was about Northwest Airlines Flight 293. This was a DC-7 that left JBLM, known as McCord Air Force Base in those days, on June 3rd, 1963, headed for Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage, Alaska. It never arrived. The plane, with 101 souls aboard, Army and Air Force members and their families, crashed into the ocean near Annette Island in southeast Alaska, leaving only a small amount of floating debris and no clues as to why it crashed. I've had the honor of speaking with friends and family members of many of those lost on Flight 293, and I continue to hear from people with connections to the flight pretty regularly. I recently spoke with Connie Miller of Gresham, Oregon. She lost her younger sister, Jewel Smith, her nephew, Rance, who was just 2.5, and her niece, Patricia, who was only 6 weeks old. These are Jewel's two kids. Connie Miller said the tragedy changed her parents immediately.
My mother and father left as a middle-aged couple up to take their daughter to put her on a plane with grandchildren. And what started walking up the sidewalk was two old people. It just aged them instantly.
You know, and it's been 57 years, and Connie Miller was emotional at times when I spoke with her. She said, essentially, the pain of losing those three family members never really completely goes away. One thing that helped, Connie told me, was dreams.
I had a lot of dreams. I would dream over the years that they were found on some obscure island someplace, and the kids were teenagers. And that was pretty much my thing through all those years.
You know, and I get pretty emotional talking to these people sometime. Connie Miller and others who lost people on the flight feel like the Air Force sort of let them down, like their relatives disappeared, and there was never really anything said about it. The plane, of course, was never found. The first person I spoke with about Flight 293 a couple of years ago was Greg Barrowman. He lost his brother Bruce. Greg has a website. He's hoping to create a public memorial. He's asked the military to search for the plane, and they've turned him down a few times. I reached out to Paul Allen's organization a year ago, and they said no to a search as well. Earlier this week, I spoke with Scott Williams. In his day job, he's an archaeologist for WashDOT, but he's also a volunteer researcher and a diver with the Maritime Archaeological Society. He said a search for Flight 293 in 8,000 feet of water, even when the location of where it hit is known, that search might cost tens of millions of dollars, and like the recent search for the Malaysian airliner MH370, it might not turn up anything.
As those bits and pieces settle down through 8,000 feet of water, they move. They don't sink straight down. They're going to hit currents. Some of them are going to kind of drift one way or the other. So it's not like you're going to have one crash site with an airplane sitting on the bottom. You've probably got a debris field of little pieces over a huge area.
So it's not very encouraging for the families who want that closure of finding that Flight 293. Now, Scott Williams is involved with another search for a plane in a much smaller area. A Navy plane, a two-seat trainer, left from the old Sandpoint Naval Air Station on Lake Washington, where Magnuson Park now stands. The plane, with two aviators aboard, 23-year-old Ensign Gaston Mays and 25-year-old Lieutenant Benjamin Vreeland, took off on March 11, 1949 for a two-hour flight and never returned. Now, the real poignant part about that story is the mother of Gaston Mays. She lived in Tennessee. She came out with her family that summer of 49 to try to track down what happened to the plane. And she ended up coming back every year for 19 years to search for that plane every summer. Now, the search eventually narrowed to Black Lake in the Cascade Foothills near Carnation. They'd found some pieces that might be from the plane. There was other evidence. Other people had seen some things. And I said the search area is pretty small. The lake's about 600 feet by 1,700 feet. It's about 35 feet deep. It's very muddy on the bottom. And now there's two local volunteers who are continuing the search. One is a veteran and a former pilot named Lee Corbin. Lee often helps me out with story ideas and research. His name comes up on Seattle's Morning News a couple times, every so often. The other guy looking is named Sean Murphy. Sean told me yesterday that the most recent search earlier this year sent divers down to examine what are called anomalies or potential targets that a magnetometer, you know, like a metal detector type of thing, had detected. Now, the recent divers ran into the same issue that searchers did when Black Lake was first examined 60 years ago.
The divers went out and tried to check the anomalies. The one stuck his arm in all the way up to his neck, about 2.5 feet down, and still did not find solid surface bottom. The other one took a rod and poked it down about almost 4 feet. And again, didn't find any solid bottom, meaning the mud is much thicker than we even anticipated.
Now, the next step for the Black Lake search is to get a ground-penetrating radar to be able to see deep into that mud. I mean, it's at least 4 feet deep. It might be a lot deeper. And a two-seater Navy trainer is a pretty small artifact to be looking for. Sean Murphy and Lee Corbett are hoping the Navy will support that effort because that plane still belongs to the Navy. Those are two lost naval aviators. And both men would like to see a monument at Black Lake. Lee Corbin's a former pilot himself, a military pilot. He feels like he owes it to those two men to conduct the search until, you know, something is finalized. Now, Scott Williams' main project lately was solving the mystery of the legendary beeswax ship. This is down near Manzanita on the Oregon coast. When I was a little kid, nobody knew where the ship was from. They just talked about these big chunks of beeswax that had been turning up literally since the time of Lewis and Clark. Now, with some geologic sleuthing and brilliant archival work, a team a couple years ago identified the ship as a Spanish galleon called the Santo Cristo de Burgos. It was headed from Manila to Acapulco. It got way off course in 1693 when it ran aground there near Manzanita, spilled the cargo of beeswax and other trade items from the Far East. Now, the mystery is solved, but the team is raising money for the next step, which is to locate the actual wreck. They haven't found the wreck, only artifacts over the last couple hundred years. And it's not really to find more artifacts on the bottom, but to sort of punctuate the project. And one thing, in talking to Scott Williams and to Sean Murphy and to, you know, the family members from 293, one thing these searches all have in common is they're not about anyone getting rich.
It's not the treasure, it's answering that historical mystery. When did a ship wreck on the Oregon coast, and where did it come from, and why was it there? And if we could answer that, I mean, we're done. We don't need to find it and recover tons of artifacts. For the crashed Navy plane in Black Lake, specifically, it's two guys who are just really interested in trying to confirm if the plane is there so they can tell the surviving family members, yes, this is where the plane crashed. The bodies of the two pilots were certainly in the lake and just never found. So it's kind of a closure thing for those families. So I guess that would be the same thing for the crashed airliner. If you're a family member, people would like to have that closure.
As for that that last crash, the Black Lake crash, I mean, is it is it confirmed that that's where it went down? It's just the mud is so thick, there's no real confirmation?
Well, I mean, They found part of a aviator's uniform. A ranger had seen the color of the lake change to the color of the dye packet that would have been in an aviator's life jacket. Nobody actually saw it go in, but there's some treetops that were broken off. It's all sort of, I guess you'd call it, circumstantial evidence. But so many people are convinced it's there. Certainly Sean Murphy and Lee Corbin are. But because the mud is so thick, when divers went down, they couldn't see anything. That's why they need this ground-penetrating radar. And this notion of closure, it's sort of, I don't know, it's cliched in a way. Yeah. And different family members from Flight 293, some don't care if the plane is searched for or ever found. Some do care. Most want some kind of monument or something, either at McCord or, you know, JBLM or somewhere, that somehow commemorates the fact that these people, most of whom were in service to the government either directly or as family members, were lost, you know, in conducting that job or being part of that effort during the Cold War. So it's just, I mean, even with the people on the Spanish galleon 300 years ago, those family members back in Spain, they never knew what happened to their family members. So it's sort of this just centuries-old, age-old quest to figure out what happens when somebody, you know, literally disappears.
Felix Spinell, brought to us by the King County Library System. Thank you, Felix. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Aaron.
Let's turn now to the rest of the world. The Pentagon announced this morning that we are pulling thousands of troops out of Germany.
Of the 11,900, nearly 5,600 service members will be repositioned within NATO countries, and approximately 6,400 will return to the United States, though many of these or similar units will begin conducting rotational deployments back to Europe.
That's Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Let's discuss now with military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. He joins us live. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, Aaron. Good morning to you.
Remind us why we have so many troops in Germany to begin with.
Well, obviously, the United States maintains a large troop presence in Germany, somewhat of a hangover from the Cold War. When I was spending my time in Germany on numerous assignments, we had over 200,000 troops in Europe as part of our commitment to NATO during the Cold War. Obviously, that drew down dramatically at the end of the Cold War. So the purpose is now a much smaller force, a little over 30,000 at present in Germany. is one, to deter still aggressive action by the Russian Federation. And we see the Russians, of course, occupying Crimea and conducting a surrogate war in eastern Ukraine. And Germany and Europe serves as a pivot point for U.S. deployment of forces to the Middle East and elsewhere. And last but not least, still that commitment to our NATO partners.
Depending on how the presidential election turns out, what does the future look like? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, what is President Trump's strategy there, and what is the presumptive nominee Joe Biden's strategy?
Well, I think this plan might not survive if President Trump is not reelected. It's very curious to me that even Republicans don't like this particular idea. And 22 Republican members of the House Armed Services Committee actually wrote a letter to the president saying pulling troops suddenly out of Germany was a bad idea. All it did was encourage the Russians, who have shown very, very aggressive action, as I said before, on Eastern Europe. So that might not, it might not even survive that particular effort. Secondly, of course, moving the forces of this size is going to take a long period of time, probably years and not months, simply because it's not only the movement of the forces, but where do you put them? Even bringing them back here to the United States for roughly 6,500, which is about two brigade equivalents, is going to cost billions of dollars, not only in relocation, but actually in the construction of infrastructure for a base here to accommodate. In addition, moving 5,000 plus forces elsewhere in Europe is also going to cost enormous amount of money and cause for us to build a lot more infrastructure before they can effectively be moved.
Let's talk a bit now about the latest tensions between the United States and Iran. I'm seeing this morning that Iran attacked a fake U.S. aircraft carrier. What happened there?
Well, the Iranians, and I think this may be more for domestic consumption than international consumption, quite frankly, constructed a mock-up of a Nimitz-class destroyer or aircraft carrier, forgive me, and towed it out into their territorial waters and then launched missiles at it from shore batteries as well as from helicopters, and had some of their fast boats, you know, run around it on the outside as a demonstration of force. This comes at a time when, of course, there is still ongoing tension between the United States and Iran, which goes back to the killing of General Soleimani back in January. And right now, an ongoing debate in the United Nations, where the United States is endeavoring in the Security Council to extend an arms embargo on Iran, which is somewhat controversial, particularly with the Russians and the Chinese.
I'm also seeing headlines this morning about a Taliban truce this morning in Afghanistan. I feel like we've heard that before, though.
Yeah, we've heard this song before, ever since we signed this peace agreement with the United States with the Taliban back in February. And that was supposed to begin a process of negotiations then between the Kabul government and the Taliban for an overall political settlement, which has never happened. In fact, we've seen violence between the Taliban attacking more Afghan security forces, initially rurally and now more in cities, since we signed that particular document. The United States has reduced its forces down in Afghanistan to about 8,600. So this announcement of a three-day ceasefire for the Muslim holy day of Eid is hoped might reignite those negotiations between Kabul and the Taliban. President Ghani has said that he would begin the final release of Taliban prisoners that the government holds and expects the Taliban to release Afghan prisoners back to the government, which was part of that initial agreement.
I mean, do 3 days of negotiations, is that a realistic plan right there?
Well, it won't be 3 days of negotiation. It'll be 3 days of ceasefire,
right?
Whether that ceasefire then could be extended and then be the basis now for negotiation to begin will be the question. Our senior negotiator, Ambassador Khalilzad, I noticed, has made a sudden trip to Kabul, and I'm sure he's trying to urge both sides to perhaps extend these 3 days to a longer ceasefire, which might then establish the basis where negotiations could, in fact, begin.
Military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Aaron.
We need some kindness, Colin.
Let's take a deep breath.
Yes.
3 months later, we have an update on the Michigan newspaper delivery driver who became so much more to the people along his route. Here's CBS's Steve Hartman.
Long before social distancing, Greg Daly was already keeping his customers at arm's length. In fact, to those on his paper route in central New Jersey, Greg has never been anything more than a blur past their driveway. But as we first reported in April, all that changed when one elderly customer asked him a simple favor.
Could he please pull in and throw the paper closer to the garage?
It hit me that if she can't get the paper at the sidewalk, which is 20 feet from the house, in this pandemic, how is she going to get the things she needs? So a couple of days later, I just decided, you know what, I'm going to put this note out.
The note, stuck in the next day's edition, said, "My name is Greg Daly, and I deliver your newspaper every morning," which was news to most people. "I would like to offer my services, free of charge, to anyone who needs groceries."
It'll be
from that moment to this,
tomorrow, okay?
The phone has been ringing off the hook.
Inundated.
He takes the orders, does the shopping, and delivers the groceries, not by whipping them out the window, but by carefully placing them on the porch.
How are you?
And boy, are people grateful.
Step back and I'll put them in the house for you.
Eileen Stein is 85 and recently widowed.
I don't have enough adjectives. He is one of the finest people in the world.
The lady at this house went even further, called him the closest thing to God.
There's a level of appreciation here, Steve, that goes above and beyond anything I've ever seen. But no, I'm not going to stop.
Well, you'll stop when this is done. Greg said, not necessarily.
There's something about being able to do something really nice for people.
And sure enough, since this story first aired, Greg has expanded his mission. About 130 seniors are now on his grocery route.
My pleasure.
He's also added about a dozen volunteers, mostly college students, who assist with the shopping. And he has plans to do still more.
Okay.
Greg Daly was called to duty by circumstance, but he's staying in service by choice.
Have a great day, all right?
Steve Hartman, CBS News, on the road.
We might be 4 months into this pandemic, but it is not too late to help a senior in your neighborhood. Also, some of the most fun people to talk to.
Absolutely.
I'll be honest. Yeah. I have a lot of senior neighbors and enjoy. I just learned one was a nurse for many years, and so she had a lot of thoughts about the pandemic happening right now. I actually learned a lot from her.
Yeah.
So Daily Dose, sponsored by Mike Novak and List with Novak.com. We appreciate that. Help a senior.
Yeah, I've got lucky to have grandparents in their 80s and 90s still around. So
yeah.
Lots of good life lessons from them.
Mm-hmm.
Help them out. And now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Kyle Radio, we have G. Scott. How you feeling this morning, G?
I'm great, man. Good morning. Happy Wednesday to all of you guys. Colleen, is Colleen there?
Mm-hmm. Colleen's here.
Yes, I'm here.
Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning.
I just wanted to make sure you're there. yeah, you know, I know everybody was excited about Monday, right? Like, everybody's like, oh, it's going to be so hot. It's going to be so great.
Colleen
was
not excited. What do you mean, everybody?
Oh, hey, Colleen, you and I in the same boat.
Yeah.
Like, when people are excited like that, I'm like, yo, I ain't really trying to be that hot. But I will say, Monday came, and you know what? I put the fan on me. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then yesterday came, and last night I was like, "Whoa, it's chilly." You know what I mean?
What's your threshold for temperature? I've moved mine. It used to be 72 and sunny. Now I'm up to 80. Mm. I'll accept 80, but anything higher than 80, unnecessary.
You know what is a... I'm glad you ask it like that. You know what's beautiful to me? 77. Mm. I don't know why. Mm. It's just 77 just says everything you need. 77 is your sunglasses on. 77 is your hanging out eating. 77 says you're not too hot. 77 says you're not too cold.
Yep.
So 77 is my deal.
Yeah. 77 is also my drink of choice. So
I don't even know what that is.
Okay. 77.
Oh. All right.
Anyways, let's talk about another Scott right now. Mackenzie Scott, no relation to you, G. For a successful
that's not how you treat a guest. I mean, why don't you ask me if there's any relation?
Don't you wish
is there
was your
any
auntie?
Relation to Mackenzie Scott, G?
No.
Okay. All right. Now we can move on. Thank you for that. But she has had this very successful post-divorce rebranding. She was Mackenzie Bezos. But the first time her name has popped up in headlines now is Mackenzie Scott. Go figure is when she...
That's just reclaiming her maiden name, isn't it?
Fair point. Fair point, like, Colleen.
Women don't rebrand themselves.
No, that's a fair point, Colleen. I think you're right about that. So reclaiming her name just in time to make a $1.7 billion charitable donation, G.
I've never seen anybody say to the world, put some respect on my name right. in this way. I've never seen anyone, usually when there's a name change, like, oh, in the news today, Mackenzie Bezos goes back to her original name of Mackenzie Scott. That's what, no, she comes in and says, bam, this is what I'm doing. You'll never forget my name. I mean, the fact that you're talking about $1.67 billion to organizations, racial equity, gender equity, economic mobility, 91%. Of the racial equity organizations are run by leaders of color. Mackenzie Scott, I'm going to say her name as many times as I can today.
And apparently she's got at least $34 billion more to put out there, and she's going to, because she signed that giving pledge, I think it was called, where, you know, wealthy individuals say they will donate a majority of their wealth, which, great. I'm glad this exists. This is the sort of tension I always feel when I get involved in the mega millions, mega jackpots, or whatever they're called, is I start to get anxiety about what to do to help if I win, right? Like, it almost becomes too much for me to imagine the help that's needed out there. So, you know, I'm happy that wealthy individuals are thinking about giving rather than passing it on to their offspring.
You know, I used to hear about, you know, people saying it's great to be a giver, and this was, you know, I was like, yeah, sounds good, but I could do a lot with the money. And then the older we get, I think we realize and we really understand now, like, well, yeah, what can you do with the money? I mean, after you buy a nice house, nice car, after your kids are set for life, then what, right? Like, what else is there other than to give? And I think that must be, like, one of the greatest feelings in the world, to be able to give that much.
I would love to be bored with money. So much so that I decide, yeah, I'll just give it all away.
Right. Colleen, if you won a lot of money yesterday, tomorrow, would you still come to work?
That's what I'm saying. Are you trying to trigger my anxiety? I mean, it's a lot. Of course, I'd take care of my loved ones, but then I would think I would just start helping, those who can't help themselves, like children, like animals. I mean, I think that's what I go for. But if it were yesterday, then yeah, I think it would go towards causes that are important today, like racial and gender equity.
But GS, if you'd come back to work.
Oh, if I'd come back to work?
Yeah.
I can't say, because I'm not a billionaire, but I right. sure do love what we do here in radio. So I'd hope that I could at least, maybe I'd start my own radio station.
I would compete
with Cairo Radio.
Look, check this out. I would still come to work, but I would have a different way of being, especially when I talk to our bosses there.
What do you mean?
I just would just, like, you know, if the boss would talk to you, like, I would respond different. I'd respond with no filter if I won a lot of money. But I'd still come to work, and the bosses would be like, why don't you just retire? You've got a lot of money. I'm like, no, I want to make life hard for you.
Invoices are too important to retire just because of money.
Absolutely.
What about you? What about you, Aaron? What would you do with your...
I'd like to say I'd come back to work if I was a billionaire, but I'm going to be honest.
He's also standing next to his boss right now.
I'm not. Let's be real here. I ain't coming back.
You're not coming back? No. Well, no. I tell you, the first thing, if I were to get rich, the first thing I'm doing, buying an air conditioner.
It costs a pretty penny to get air conditioning, doesn't it?
You know, because here's why. People are like, well, you can buy one now. I cannot justify buying an air conditioner that you really, really only need about, what, 5 days out of the year?
Because they're like $400 for the stand-up ones.
Yeah, $400, $500. That's too much money for me.
Right. Yeah.
G. Scott, we will hear you again at 9 this morning. Thanks for the time, G.
This is Seattle's Morning News. We are, of course, in a big discussion about the use of force by police, but there's also a wider discussion as to why, and I get this from listeners all the time. Dave, the slaves were liberated on Juneteenth back in 1865, and we've had the civil rights movement in the 60s. And yet still, when we look at all the metrics, black families are behind. How long do we wait until that's changed? And that's why I wanted to call Sean Rochester. He's written a book called The Black Tax, The Cost of Being Black in America. And you are one of the few people who's actually addressing this fundamental difference between the type of system and economic circumstances that a white child is born into as opposed to a black child. So a typical email or message I might get is, Dave, I'm a white person, but I wasn't born into wealth. And or my parents come over here from a European country with nothing in their pockets, and they built up this fantastic business, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Black people were emancipated many years ago.
Yeah.
And yet for some reason, they can't keep their families together. They can't build substantial businesses.
Yeah.
And they're always asking the government for help. So I know it's a long story. I mean, I listened to one of your talks, and it takes about an hour to go through all this history. But is there a shorthand way you can address why this disparity is so stubborn?
Yeah. So, you know, I try to look at why is it that after all this time, black people only own about 2% of U.S. wealth, right?
Yeah.
Which is driving a lot of these socioeconomic problems that we're seeing right now. So the short version is, for about a 246-year period, you have labor extracted from black people under conditions in which they're not able to accumulate any wealth because they literally are the capital, right? And they are the wealth. And the wealth that was extracted from them during that period of time has been estimated, you know, as high as $50 trillion. And just to help people understand, like, you know, the value of enslaved people to America, if you go back to 1860, you know, they're 50% of the full economic value of the South, right? Just those 4 million people, they're generating about 61% of U.S. exports is that raw cotton. They're 80% of the global cotton market is dominated by the U.S., the free labor from these people. Raw cotton is kind of like the oil market. It was the first, you know, globalized market. And industrialization really happened on the backs of the kind of the textile industry. So it's a massive portion, and it's so large, the value of those people, that you have to measure it in terms of like national wealth or GDP. Those people were somewhere between 16 and 20% of U.S. wealth. So if you look at pre-COVID, national wealth was about $85 trillion. So if you put that in today's dollars, that's somewhere between $14 and $17 trillion, or about 15.5 if you took an average of those things. The other way economists look at it is from a perspective of national income. So their value is 1 to 2 years of national income or GDP. So if you looked at what those numbers were pre-COVID, it was about $19 trillion a year. So you're talking somewhere between 19 and 38 trillion. Take an average here at 28.5. That's two different.
And so this is like this is a gift to the American economy, basically.
Absolutely. There's no way to disaggregate black people and the value that was extracted from their labor from the development of the country. One does not exist without the other.
Okay. So slavery ends, except, as you point out, slavery doesn't end.
Right.
So explain that.
Yeah, so you the first thing we have to kind of understand is that these people leave bondage with no economic resources, right? We hear about the 40 acres and a mule, but that actually never happens. And if you think about how you would price that, it would be about $1 trillion in today's equivalent. If you took, you know, 40 acres times 4 million people, 160 million acres, and you just looked at farmland, you kind of come up with that kind of number. They leave with no economic resources. And there's a short period of reconstruction that we hear a lot of conversation about, but they're plunged very quickly into this Jim Crow structure. And this Jim Crow structure is really a reimposition of 100% tax on black people's labor. Which is what
it's not just an expression of prejudice. And this is the important concept to me. The Jim Crow laws were not just there to express the hatred of black people, but they were there to literally reimpose slavery. So explain how that worked.
Yeah. So slavery, by definition, is a 100% tax on your labor, right? It just means nothing that you produce is yours, right? And in effect, nothing, you are not yours. So when you go into this Jim Crow system, it's effectively a contract, right? So those large mega plantations are broken into smaller lots. Black families settle on those lots and they agree to plant cash crops under the terms and conditions of a contract that's all set by the small white farmer. But the problem is because they have no wealth, all of the supplies that they need, food, clothing, tools, everything has to be supplied by that white farmer at rates up to 70% a year. So they set your whole cost structure. And then at the end of the season, when you take those crops to market, that white farmer is the market. They actually tell you what it's worth. So a person sets your cost structure and they also set your revenue. By definition, they set your profit. So if you're lucky, your profit will net to zero. And if you're unfortunate, it'll be negative and they'll roll it into the next year. And then you have perpetual debt servitude. So that's how you get into the situation of having 100% tax on your labor. But it's across millions of people for well over a 75-year period.
So it sounds like we are America as a country is nowhere near doing what needs to be done to even begin to equalize this gap. Now, you are a supporter of reparations, is that correct?
That's correct.
And what form would that take? An outright federal grant or a tax on everybody above a certain, amount of wealth, or what would it be?
So let me give you an example. Let's say it was a cash payment, simplest kind of form. Well, right now, Black people, only about 2% of the total spend of Black people in America actually goes to Black enterprise, because the business infrastructure, because of this 150-year trauma post-slavery and during the time of slavery, was never allowed to fully develop. It's really a fraction of what it should be, right? So we don't have the business infrastructure for Black Americans to spend through that will be in itself stimulative within the community. If you did that, it would be the greatest economic stimulus that the world has ever seen, because most of the things that Black people would need to purchase and consume, we don't necessarily own, right? You would buy houses that weren't built, right, by Black labor, right, the resources didn't come from, Black companies. You'd buy cars that are not owned by Black, manufacturers. There are Black auto dealers, but they're tiny, 264 out of 16,000 pre-COVID. So you would have a tremendous amount of consumption, which would be fantastic. You would have significant savings by certain parts of the group, which would be terrific. But we would lose the multiplier effect of actually stimulating more jobs within the community. Right. So I think there really needs to be a business infrastructure in place to do that. One of the things I think people need to really understand is that helping to develop Black enterprise and Black people and Black intellect is actually a gigantic win for the country. So when you think about what the country is losing, right, my analysis says that having excluded Black talent from the innovation system is costing the country about $2 trillion a year. If you look at McKinsey and Company, their analysis says that if you could close the wealth gap, it would stimulate about $1.5 trillion of GDP growth.
So you're saying that reparations might pay for themselves?
Yeah. You'd have to calculate the return period. But yeah, everybody benefits.
Nobody's made that argument that I've heard about. Anytime reparations comes up, it is presented as either a tax on people or you're actually taking something from somebody and just giving it to somebody else. But you're making a point I've never heard made before. I heard it made with women, how for years and years we wasted the talents of half the population because women didn't have a chance.
Absolutely.
But it's never been made with Black people, that you have the same distribution of talent among Blacks as among anybody else. And yet for years that has been systematically, essentially, wasted.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for spending the time to explain this. I wanted to take some time because I attempt to answer these emails when they come in, but it's very difficult to convince people that it is still not a level playing field, because the assumption seems to be that a switch was flipped when Abraham Lincoln signed that document, or at the very least when the Civil Rights Act was passed, and that anybody who hasn't been able to thrive since then has only themselves to blame.
Absolutely.
And that appears not to be the case.
Yeah, it is absolutely not the case. And the thing is that it's not hard to come to that conclusion if you have no understanding, because all the messaging is telling you that you're right. And then when you're in school, it's all left out of the curriculum. So you don't have a counterbalance to that level of thinking, and you're getting all this other information. And if you don't have that information, you don't have context, you're going to blame the individual without looking at the context of the environment in which those individuals are functioning. If you put anybody in the situation of which, Black people are in, you're not going to be able to accumulate wealth. This was an elegant, diabolically efficient designed, right? It was not accidental by any means, and it was extremely effective.
Sean Rochester is the CEO of Good Steward. It's a financial education and advisor company and is the author of The Black Tax. If you Google Sean Rochester, S-H-A-W-N, and Black Tax, you'll find him all over the internet. Sean, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.